My father had perished in his sleep of an aneurysm when I was young. My mother had died in childbirth. Or had they? A sudden, burning desire to know filled me, started in my gut and rolled outwards through my body, to know who my mother was, what she had known. She had left me her silver pentacle, but I knew nothing of the sort of person she was, other than what my gentle and too generous father had told me before his death. What were my parents like? How had they perished, and why? Had they been killed? Did they have enemies lurking out there somewhere? If so, had I inherited them? My mother's dark past. Did that explain my own fascination with the darker powers, my somewhat less than sterling adherence to the rules of the White Council that I considered foolish or inconvenient? I looked up at the demon and felt like a sucker. I had been set up. He had intended all along to dangle this information in front of me as bait. He wanted to get my whole name, if he could, or more. "I can show them to you, Harry Blackstone Dresden, as they really are," Sean Zagaroth assured me, his voice dulcet. "You've never seen your mother's face. I can give that to you. You've never heard her voice. I can let you hear that as well. You know nothing of what sort of people your parents were, or if you have any other family out there." "Family, Harry Blackstone Dresden. Blood. Every bit as tormented and alone as you are." I stared at the demon's hideous form and listened to the soothing, relaxing voice. Family. Was it possible I had family? Aunts, uncles, cousins. Others, like me, perhaps, moving through the secret societies of the wizards, hidden from the view of the mortal world. "The price is comparatively low. What need have you for your immortal soul when your body is finished with it? What harm to pass on to me only one more name? This is not information easily gained, even by my kind. You may not have the chance to garner it again." The demon pressed his pincers against the barrier of the conjuring circle. His beak-like maw fairly trembled with eagerness. "Forget it," I said quietly. "No deal." Sean Zagaroth's jaw dropped open. "But Harry Blackstone Dresden," he began. I didn't realize I was shouting until I saw him flinch. "I said, forget it! You think I'm some kind of simp for you to sucker in, Darkspawn? Take what you have gained and go, and feel lucky I did not send you with your bones torn from your body or your beak ground into dust." Sean Zagaroth's eyes flashed with rage, and he hurled himself against the barrier again, howling with bloodlust and fury. I extended my hand and snarled. "Oh, no you don't, you slimy little shithead." A demon's will strained against mine, and though sweat burst out on my forehead, I came out ahead once more. Sean Zagaroth began to grow smaller and smaller, howling out his frustrated rage. "We are watching you, wizard!" he screamed. "You walk through shadows, and one night you will slip and fall. And when you do, we will be there. We will be waiting to bring you down to us. You will be ours in the end." He went on like that until he shrank to the size of a pinpoint and vanished with a little imploding sound. I let my hand drop and lowered my head, breathing hard. I was shaking all over, but not only with the cold of my laboratory. I had badly misjudged Sean Zagaroth, thought him a somewhat reliable, if dangerous, source of information, willing to do reasonable business. But the rage, the fury, the frustrated malice that had been in his final offer, those last words had shown his true colors. He had lied to me, deceived me about his true nature, played me along like a sucker, and then tried to set the hook hard. I felt like such an idiot. The phone began to ring upstairs. I stirred into sudden motion, shoving stacks of things out of the way, pushing past them and over them to reach the stepladder stairs that led up to my apartment. I hurried up them, my notebook in one hand, and caught the phone on its fifth ring. My apartment was dark. Night had fallen while I was interviewing the demon. "Dresden," I said, puffing.
"Harry,"
Murphy said, her voice weak. "We've got another one." "Son of a bitch," I said. "I'm coming. Give me the address." I set down the notebook and held my pencil, ready to write. Murphy's tone was numb. 888 Ralston Place, up the Gold Coast. I froze, staring at the address I had written down on the notebook, the address the demon had given me.
"Harry,"
Murphy said,
"did you hear me?"
"I heard you," I told her. "I'm coming, Murph." I hung up the phone and headed out into the light of the full moon overhead. Chapter 12. 888 Ralston was a townhouse in the Gold Coast, the richest area of Chicago. It was set on its own little plot, surrounded by trees that hid the house from view almost entirely. High hedges worked around the house in a small garden, added to the concealment as I drove up the white pebble drive and parked the Beetle at the end of a small fleet of police cars and emergency vehicles. The strobing blue lights were almost comforting by now. I had seen them so many times that it felt, in an unsettling way, like a homecoming. Murphy had called me in early. I didn't see the forensics van yet, and only now were officers putting up yellow tape around the property. I got out of my car, dressed in my jeans, button-down shirt, and boots again, my old black duster flapping around my calves. The wind was brisk, cold. The moon was riding high overhead, barely visible through the city's haze of pollution. A chill ran down my neck and I stopped, looking at the rows and rows of elegantly illuminated hedge sculptures, flower beds, and rows of shrubbery around me. I was abruptly certain that someone was out in the darkness. I could feel eyes on me. I stared out at the night, sweeping my gaze around. I could see nothing, but I would have to bet money that there was someone out there. After a moment, the sense of being watched faded, and I shivered. I shoved my hands in my pockets and walked quickly toward the townhouse.
"Dresden,"
someone called, and I looked up to see Carmichael coming down the front stairs of the townhouse toward me. Carmichael was Murphy's right hand in special investigations. Shorter than average, rounder than average, slobbier than average, and with piggier eyes than average. Carmichael was a skeptic, a doubter, and a razor-sharp cop. He came down the stairs with a soup-stained old tie and shirt sleeves.
"It's about fucking time. Jesus Christ, Dresden."
He wiped a hand over his sweating brow. I frowned down at Carmichael, and we went up the stairs side by side.
"Well, that's the nicest greeting you've ever given me, I think," I said. "You change your mind about me being a fake?"
Carmichael shook his head. "No. Still think you're full of shit with this wizard magic business. But Christ almighty, there are times when I wish you weren't."
"You can never tell," I said, my voice dry. "Where's Murphy?"
"Inside," Carmichael said, his mouth twisting with distaste. "You go up the stairs. The whole place belongs to this guy. Murphy figures you might know something. I'm going to stay here and bog down the feds when they show." I glanced at him.
"She's still worried about looking bad for internal affairs?"
Carmichael grimaced.
"Those assholes at IA would be all over her if she kicked the feds out. Christ almighty, I get sick of city politics sometimes."
I nodded agreement and started up the stairs.
"Hey, Dresden," Carmichael said. I looked over my shoulder at him, expecting the familiar jeers and insults.
He was studying me with bright, narrow eyes.
"I hear things about you and Johnny Marconi. What's the deal?"
I shook my head.
"No deal. He's lying scum."
Carmichael studied me intently and then nodded.
"You ain't much of a liar, Dresden. I don't think you could keep a straight face about something like this.
I believe you."
"But you don't believe me when I say I'm a wizard?"
I asked. Carmichael grimaced and looked away from my eyes.
"Do I look like a fucking moron to you, huh? You better get upstairs. I'll make some noise when Denton and the Stepford agents get here."
I turned to go and saw Murphy standing at the head of the stairs in a crisp gray business jacket and slacks, with sensible low heels and jewelry the color of steel. Her earrings seemed to be little more than bright beads of silver in her ears, which I never really noticed when she had worn her golden hair long. Murphy's earlobes were cute. She'd kill me just for thinking it.
"About time, Dresden. Get up here," Her voice was hard, angry. She vanished from the top of the stairway, and I took the rest of the stairs two at a time to catch up with her. The apartment, though it was too big for the word to really apply, was brightly lit and smelled very faintly of blood. Blood has a sweet sort of metallic odor. It makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and mine snap to attention at once. There was another smell as well, maybe incense of some kind, and the fresh scent of wind. I turned down the short hall at the top of the stairs and followed Murphy into what was apparently a master bedroom, where I found the source of all the scents. There was no furniture inside the master bedroom, and it was huge. Large enough to make you wince at how far you'd have to get to the bathroom in the middle of the night. There was no carpeting. There were no decorations on the walls. There was no glass in the huge single-pane window letting in October. The full moon shone down through it like a picture in a frame. What the room did have was blood. There was blood all over, scattered in droplets and slashed in spurts against one wall. The scarlet footprints of something like a large wolf leading in a straight line toward the shattered window. In the center of the room were the remains of a greater circle of summoning, with its three rings of symbols carefully wrought in white chalk upon the wooden floor, burning sticks of incense interspersed among the symbols of the second ring. What was left of Kim Delaney lay naked and supine on the blood-stained floor a few feet from the circle. The expression of shock and surprise on her face wouldn't change until rigor set in. Her dark, once glittering eyes stared up at the ceiling, and her lips were parted as though in the middle of an apology. A large wheel section of flesh beneath her chin was missing, and with it Kim's larynx and trachea. Bloody red meat was showing, the ragged ends of arteries and torn sections of muscle, and pale white bones gleamed at the bottom of the wound. Long rakes down her body had opened her like a Ziploc bag, leaving her covered in scarlet. Something went click in my head. Someone threw some kind of switch that had just turned off my emotions entirely and immersed me in a surreal haze. I couldn't be seeing this. It simply couldn't be real. It had to be some game or hoax in which the actors would start giggling in a few moments, unable to contain the mirth of their prank. I waited, but no one started giggling. I wiped at my forehead with my hand and found cold sweat there. My fingers began to shake. Murphy said, her voice still tight with anger. Apparently the incense set off the fire alarm in the hall. When the fire department got here, no one answered, so they came on in. They found her up here about 8 o'clock. She was still warm. 8 o'clock, when I had been talking to the demon. Moonrise? Behind me, Murphy closed the door to the bedroom. I turned to her, away from the grisly corpse. There was anger in every inch of her, the way she glared at me. "Murph," I said, "I don't know if I can do this." "What's there to figure?" Murphy said. "There's a monster in the middle of a circle. I figure it's one of those loup-garou from your report. I figure it's Harley McFinn, the owner of this house. Someone who knows he's going to go nuts when the moon rises. The girl tries to hold the monster inside the magic circle, right? Something goes wrong when McFinn goes furry. He gets out of the circle, wastes her, then leaves." "Uh-huh," I said, without turning around to look at Kim's body again. "It makes sense." And I told her what I'd learned from the demon about Harley McFinn, the Northwest Passage Project, and his antagonism with Marconi's business interests. Murphy listened to me in utter silence. When I was finished, she nodded and turned to leave the room. "Follow," she said shortly. I followed, almost on her heels. I didn't turn around to see the room again before I left. She led me down the hall into another bedroom, this one furnished and neatly kept. "Come here," she said, moving to a dresser. I did, and she handed me a photograph of a middle-aged, starkly handsome man, his skin deeply tanned, the bones of his face gaunt and sharp. He was smiling. Beside him in the picture was the amber-eyed woman from the department store where I'd run across the Alphas. She was also smiling. Her teeth were very white, very even, and her dark skin and silver-peppered hair went well with the man beside her. I chewed my lip for a second, trying to think. "That's Harley McFinn," Murphy said. "Matches the picture on his driver's license. I didn't turn up any ID on the woman next to him, though." She studied my face critically. "She matches the description of the woman you said you saw in the department store, though. The one who followed us back from the scene at Rosemont. Is that her?" I nodded. "Yeah, that's her." Murphy nodded, took the picture from me, and set it on the dresser. "Follow," she said again, and walked out. I stared after her. What's wrong with Murphy? Had the scene unsettled her so much? I shook my head, still stunned from what I had seen, from too many facts coming together all at once, slam-bam in my brain. "Murph, wait," I said. "Stop a minute. What's going on?" She didn't answer me, just shot me a glare over her shoulder and continued to walk. I hurried to catch up with her. We went down what looked like a servant's narrow spiral staircase, down into the basement. She led me to the back of a storage room and pushed open a heavy steel door there that opened into a small, stark chamber, all of concrete, with no other exits. In the middle of the chamber was another three-ring summoning circle, but this one's symbols had been made from silver and set into the concrete of the floor. Short bars of what looked like a mixture of silver and obsidian were interspersed around the second circle, creating what would, if the circle was functional, be a very formidable barrier. But the symbols had been marred, torn, broken. Several from the critical inner circle had been pried up from the floor and were simply missing. Some of the bars had been broken. The circle, as it was non-functional and worthless. But whole, it would have served to contain Harley McFinn when he shifted into his beast form. The room was a prison he had created for himself, something to contain the fury of the beast inside of him. But someone had intentionally marred the circle, made the prison useless. And I abruptly understood Kim Delaney's request. She had to have known Harley McFinn, maybe through her environmental activism. She must have learned of his curse and wanted to help him. When I had refused to help her, she had attempted to recreate the greater summoning circle upstairs in the bedroom to hold in McFinn once the moon rose. As I had warned her would happen, she had failed. She hadn't had the knowledge necessary to understand how such a construct would function, and consequently, she hadn't been able to make it work. McFinn had killed her. Kim was dead because I had refused to share my knowledge with her, because I hadn't given her my help. I'd been so secure in my knowledge and wisdom, withholding such secrets from her had been the action of a concerned and reasoned adult speaking to an overeager child. I couldn't believe my own arrogance, the utter confidence with which I had condemned her to death. I started to shake, harder, too many things pressing against my mind, my heart. I could feel the pressure somewhere inside of me, that switch on the side of my head, quivering, getting ready to flick back beneath the tide of raging anger, fury, regret, self-hatred. I took deep breaths and closed my eyes, trying not to let it happen. I opened my eyes and looked up at Murphy. God, I needed to talk to her. I needed a friend. I needed someone to listen, to tell me it would be all right, whether it was the truth or not. I needed someone to let me unload on them, to keep me from flying apart. She regarded me with cold, angry eyes. Karen, I whispered. She drew from her pocket a crumpled piece of paper. She unfolded it and held it up to me so that I could see Kim Delaney's graceful handwriting, the sketch of the summoning circle she had brought to me at McAnally's, the sketch I had refused to tell Kim about, the sketch I had crumpled into a little ball and tossed on the floor, and which Murphy had picked up, absently, just to get the trash out of people's way. And I realized why there was so much anger in Murphy's eyes. I stared at the sketch. Karen, I began again. Stars above, you've got to listen to me. I took the sketch from her hands, my fingers trembling.
Harry, she said in a calm tone. You lying bastard. And on the word, she drove her fist into my stomach, hard, doubling me over. The motion put my head within easy reach, and her fists took me across the jaw in a right cross and sent me to the floor like a lump of wet pasta, stars dancing in my vision. I was only dimly aware of her taking the sketch back from me. She twisted my arms painfully behind my back and snapped her handcuffs around my wrist. You promised me, she said, her voice furious. You promised. No secrets. You lied to me all along. You played me like a sucker the entire while. God damn it, Dresden. You're involved in this and people are dying. Murph, I mumbled. Wait. She grabbed my hair, jerked my head back, and slammed me across the jaw again, near berserker anger leading her strength. My head swam, and blackness closed over my vision for several seconds. No more talking, no more lies, I heard her say, and she dragged me to my feet, shoving my face and chest against a wall to begin searching me for weapons. No more people torn up like meat on a block. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. She took my blasting rod, my shield bracelet, the energy ring, even my lump of chalk. Her voice went on, hard, cold, and professional, letting me know my rights. I closed my eyes and leaned against the stone wall. Next to my head, it was the softest thing in the room. I didn't try to fight or explain. What was the point? Chapter 13. Walking downstairs with your hands fastened behind your back is more difficult than you'd think. You depend upon your arms for balance, whether you realize it or not. With my hands cuffed at the small of my back, Murphy walked me up the narrow servant's staircase and then down the front steps of McFinn's building in front of a gaggle of staring police officers. My balance was gone. As we came down, I could hear arguing voices. You want to get in my face about this? Carmichael demanded. Look, I'm doing my job. My boss says no one was to go up, so no one goes up. Do I need to use shorter words or what? I looked up to see Denton towering over Carmichael, the veins in his forehead athrob. His three associates spread out in a fan behind him. You are interfering with a duly appointed officer executing his duties, Denton snarled. Get out of my way, Detective Carmichael, or do you want to get added to Internal Affairs' to-do list along with your boss? It's all right, John, Murphy said. I'm done with my business up here anyway. Carmichael looked up at me and stared, his mouth opening. Denton and his crew looked too. I saw Denton's face twist in surprise, then close again, hedging out any emotion from his expression. Roger, the red-haired kid who'd worked for Denton, was staring at me openly, his jaw dropped open. Ben, the woman who had attacked Murphy last night, regarded me with an almost bored expression, and Wilson, the overweight one, let out a satisfied snort. Lieutenant, Carmichael said, are you sure about this? He was arguing with the most recent deceased last night. I can connect him to at least one resident of the house, as well as some of the decorations there. I'm taking him in for obstructing and for conspiracy to commit murder. Put him in the car, Carmichael, and then get your ass upstairs. Murphy gave me a sharp push toward Carmichael, and I stumbled. Carmichael caught me. So let's go, Denton, Murphy said, and turned and stalked away. Denton gave me an expressionless face and stepped after Murphy, beckoning his companions to follow. Carmichael shook his head and walked me to one of the police cars. Fuck, Dresden. And here I was getting ready to throw in on your side. Guess I'm just a sucker for the underdog. Carmichael unlocked the back of the car and put his hand on the back of my head as I bent down to get in. Watch your head. Christ, what happened to your jaw? I sat down in the back of the car and looked straight ahead. I didn't answer him. Carmichael stared at me for a while and then shook his head. We'll have someone drive you downtown as soon as the scene is secure. You can get in touch with your lawyer then. I kept my eyes forward and didn't answer him. Carmichael studied me some more, then stood and shut me into the car. I closed my eyes. I have felt low before in my life. I have experienced events that have left me broken and groveling and wishing I was dead.
That was pretty much how I felt now, too. It wasn't that I hadn't found the killer. I've been beaten before. Taken a blow to the chin and come out fighting the next round. I can roll with the punches as well as anyone. But I hated the feeling I had betrayed a friend. I had promised Murphy that I would keep no secrets from her. And I hadn't. Not really. But I had been stupid. I should have been putting pieces together more quickly, more instinctively. Perhaps I had some excuse in that I'd been distracted by nearly having my head blown off at the Full Moon Garage, and that I'd been distracted by my soul gaze upon the Street Wolves' leader, and the knowledge that he wanted to kill me. But it wasn't good enough to clear things with Murphy. I wasn't sure anything would have been. I felt alone. I felt frustrated. I felt like shit. And I felt worse a moment later when I looked out the car window at the full moon and realized something that I should have put together an hour before. The real killer, or killers, were still out there. MacFinn couldn't have been responsible for all the deaths in the previous month. Two of the murders had occurred on nights before and after the full moon. If MacFinn's curse was indeed to become a ravening beast during the full moon, he could not have murdered either of the last month's victims, or Spike at the varsity last night. Which begged the question, who had done the killings? I didn't have any answers. If the dark-haired woman who had led the Alphas was indeed connected with MacFinn, could she have been responsible? Something wolf-like had attacked me in the abandoned department store when all the lights had been out. Had it been her? One of the Alphas? Perhaps that would explain how the other murders happened. But if it had been true, why hadn't the killer finished me off while I was floundering in the dark, virtually helpless? More and more questions, and no answers. Not that it mattered to me now. A nice, quiet jail cell actually didn't sound too bad once I thought about it. Or at least it would have kept the criminal element off my back, provided they didn't shut me up with a 400-pound con named Hump or anything. And then an odd feeling crept over me, derailing my train of thought. Once more, the hairs on my neck were standing up. Someone was watching me. I looked around. There was no one in sight. All the police were inside the house, and I was alone in the back of the patrol car with my hands bound. I was helpless and alone, and I suddenly became very aware of the fact that Harley MacFinn had not been found or apprehended. He was still lurking in the night, unable to keep from tearing apart anyone he saw. I thought of Spike's torn corpse, of poor Kim Delaney, covered in her own blood upstairs in the townhouse. I added imaginary and far more horrible images of half a dozen other victims, stacking scene upon scene of blood and death in my mind within a few seconds. I broke out in a cold sweat and looked out the other window, directly into a pair of brilliant, feral, amber eyes. I yelled and flinched away, lifting my legs to kick should something come rushing through the vehicle's window. Instead, the door opened, and the dark-haired, amber-eyed woman from the department store said, "Be quiet, Mr. Dresden, or I will not be able to rescue you." I blinked at her, up over my upraised knees. "Huh? Rescue you, Mr. Dresden? Get out of the car and come with me, and quickly, before the police return." She peered past me toward the house. "There's not much time." "Are you crazy?" I demanded. "I don't even know who the hell you are." "I am Harley MacFinn's fiance, Miss West," she said. "Call me Tara." I shook my head. "I can't leave. I'll be buying more trouble than you can imagine." Her amber eyes glinted. "You are the only one who can stop my fiance, Mr. Dresden. You cannot do that from a jail cell." "I'm not the Lone Ranger," I snapped in reply. "I'm a hired consultant, and I don't think the city is going to foot the bill for this sort of thing." Tara West's teeth showed. "If money is your concern, I assure you that it is not a problem, Mr. Dresden. Time presses. Will you come or not?" I studied her face. She had clean, striking features, exceptional more than attractive. There were crow's feet at the edges of her eyes and mouth, though they were the only sign of age on her that I could see. There was, along the edge of her forehead, at the hairline, a long, slender, purpling bruise. "You," I said. It was you who attacked me in the department store. I hit you. You took my rod away from me. She glared at me. Yes, she said. You're a werewolf. And you, she said, are a wizard. And we have no more time. She crouched a bit lower, staring past me. I looked in that direction and saw Denton and his cronies exiting the townhouse, engaged in an animated discussion. Your friend, she said, the police detective, is close to finding my fiancé. Do you really want her to be the one to face him? Is she prepared to deal with what she will find? Or will she die, as the others did? Damn it. The bitch, no pun intended, was right. I was the one who was capable of actually doing something about McFinn. If Murphy was the one to catch up to him first, people would get killed. She was a fantastic cop, and was becoming more adept at dealing with the supernatural, but she wasn't able to handle a major werewolf berserker. I turned back to Tara. If I go with you, you'll take me to McFinn. She stopped in the midst of turning to leave. When I can, at dawn, if you think you can create a circle, hold him in when the moon rises, if you can help him. I nodded once. My decision was made. I can. I will. She, who is called Kim Delaney, said the same thing, Tara West said, and spun on her heels to head away from me, crouching low to the ground. I rolled out of the back seat and followed Tara West out to the shrubberies and garden shadows around the building, away from the police cars and lights. Someone shouted in surprise, somewhere behind me. Then there was a cry of, "Stop!" I just stood and ran, as fast as I could, to get out of the lights and the line of sight of any possible shooters. Apparently the one shout was all the warning I was going to get. Gunfire erupted behind me as I ran. Bullets tore up the dirt next to my feet. I think I started screaming without slowing down, hunching my shoulders and ducking my head as best I could. I was maybe 5 feet away from the sheltering shadows behind the hedges when something slammed into my shoulder and threw me through the hedge and out the other side. I landed on a roll and stumbled halfway back to my feet. There was a second of screaming, confused input from my shoulder, as though my joints would suddenly hear a welter of sound, feel a broad variety of sensation and texture beneath my skin, and my shoulder went numb entirely, and my vision started spinning. I reached out a hand to support myself as I started to fall, and remember that my wrists were still cuffed behind me. I went into the turf, felt the grass against my cheek. "He's down! He's down!" came a cold female voice. "Agent Benz," I thought. "Take him!" There was no warning of presence, just the feeling of someone jerking me up to my feet by my duster. I felt Tara's hand slide beneath my jacket, then vanish as she pressed it to the numbed area of my arm. "You're not bleeding badly," Tara said, her voice calm. "You were shot in the shoulder, not the leg. Run or die." Then she turned and started making her way through the hedges. Some encouragement, but I had a hunch that I'd be feeling a lot worse a few minutes from now. So I swallowed the sickly taste of fear and loped after Tara West as best I could. We started a game of shadow, hide and seek in the little garden, Tara and me, against the agents behind us. She moved like a wraith in utter silence, smooth and steady in the black shadows and silver light of the moon overhead. She immediately cut into the hedges, taking lefts and rights every few paces. She did not slow down for me, and I was somehow very certain that McFinn's fiancé would not stop and wait for me, should I fall. I did, for a while. It wasn't even too hard. I felt a little out of breath, a little hampered by the handcuffs, but other than that, it was almost as though I hadn't been shot, aside from the trickling warmth I could feel sliding down my ribs and over my belly. Endorphins, what a rush. Our pursuers plunged into the maze of hedges and shrubs and statuary, but my guide seemed to have an uncanny knack for avoiding them. She kept to the darkest parts of the garden as we went, checking behind her to make sure I was keeping pace. I wasn't sure how much time passed that way, ghosting through the darkness while our pursuers struggled to coordinate their efforts and remain quiet at the same time, but it couldn't have been long. I read somewhere that the initial shock of gunshot injuries always wears off after a few moments. Besides, I was out of shape. I couldn't keep up with Tara West for long. She was that fast, that good. My shoulder began to pound double time to my laboring heart as we emerged from the last of the hedges to the street outside. And the 8-foot wrought iron fence that surrounded the property, I slid to a halt and stumbled against the fence, wheezing. Tara looked over her shoulder, her amber eyes bright beneath the moon. She was breathing through her nose, silently. The crouched run having not tired her in the least, it seemed. "I can't climb the fence," I said. The pain from my shoulder was starting to become very real now. It felt like a runner's cramp, only higher up. "There's no way, not with my hands cuffed." Tara nodded once. "I will lift you," she said. I stared at her through a growing haze of pain, then sighed. "You'd better hurry then," I said. "I'm about to pass out." She took the words in stride and said, "Lean against the fence. Keep your body stiff." Then she seized my ankles. I did my best to follow her instructions, and she heaved, straining with effort. For a second, nothing happened. And then she started, very slowly, to move me up, my good shoulder against the fence. She kept pressing my ankles higher until I bent forward at the waist, scrabbled with my legs for a second, and then tumbled gracelessly to the ground at the far side of the fence. I hit the ground, and as I did, a nuclear weapon went off in my shoulder, white fire, blinding heat. I sucked in a breath and tried not to scream, but some sound must have escaped. There was a shout from somewhere behind me and the sound of voices converging on our position. Tara grimaced and turned her face to the oncoming voices. "Hurry up," I gasped. "Climb it and let's go." She shook her head, a stirring of dark hair. "No time. They are here." I gritted my teeth until they creaked and I got my feet underneath me. She was right. The oncoming voices were close. Someone, Ben again, I thought, shouted out orders not to move. If Tara tried to clamber over the fence now, she was a perfect target at the top. The pursuers were too close. Tara didn't stand much chance of escaping, and if she didn't, I wouldn't make it far. I'd be caught, and in more trouble than ever, and McFinn would be on a rampage with no one to oppose him. I blinked sweat out of my eyes and knelt down as my blood pattered to the sidewalk. Little curls of steam came up where it hit the cold concrete. I took a breath and drew in every bit of will I could summon, drew in the pain and my fear and sick frustration and shoved it all into a hard little ball of energy. "Ventas veloce," I murmured. "Ubrium, ubrium." I repeated the words in a breathless little chant, curling my fingers in towards my palm as I did. The curls of steam from my blood began to thicken and gather into dense tendrils of mist and fog. Back along our trail, where more of my blood had spilled, more fog arose. For a few seconds it was nothing, just a low and slithering movement along the ground, and then it erupted forth, billows of fog rising to cover the ground as the energy rushed out of me, covering Tara from my sight and causing shouts of confusion and consternation to come from the law officials pursuing us. I dropped to my side, overwhelmed by pain and fatigue. There was a whisper of sound, a creak of wrought metal, and then a light thump as Tara West landed beside me, invisible in the fog, though she was only a few feet away. She moved toward me, and then I saw her expression, her eyes wide with wonder, the first emotion I had seen on her face. "Wizard," she whispered. "Don't wear it out," I mumbled. And then everything went black. Chapter 14. I woke up someplace dark and warm, but then I opened my eyes and it wasn't dark anymore, just dim. I was in a hotel room, a cheap one, laying on my back on a double bed. Heavy curtains were drawn, but cheap curtain rods sagged in the middle and let light in from outside. I felt that I'd been lying there for a while. I took a deep breath, and it made my shoulder begin a dull, pounding throb. I moaned before I could think to keep quiet. I'm not a wimp, but it just hurt that bad. My throat was parched, my lips chapped. I turned my head, which made my jaw ache where Murphy had socked me. My left shoulder was covered in thick white bandages and wrapped firmly in tape. It looked clean and neat, except for the bruises I could see spreading out toward my chest and down my arm from beneath the bandages. As a side note, I noticed I was naked. and the list of candidates for who could have undressed me was awfully short. Beyond my shoulder on the nightstand beside the bed was a pile of miscellany. A book entitled SAS Survival Manual lay open to a page with several black and white illustrations of bandaging techniques. Beside it were some empty cardboard boxes whose labels declared them to have once contained cotton gauze wrapping, medical tape, that sort of thing. A brown bottle of hydrogen peroxide lay on its side atop a hacksaw with a nicked blade. I moved my right hand to rub my aching head. One bracelet of Murphy's handcuffs hung around my wrist, the chain swinging from the base of the bracelet, where it had apparently been severed by a hacksaw. The other bracelet was on my left wrist. I could feel it as a dull, throbbing band around the lower part of my arm. I did my best not to move too much, but the pain didn't go away. After a few minutes, I decided that my wound wasn't going to start hurting any less, so I sat up, slowly. Rising wasn't too much more trouble, though my legs shook a little. I made it to the bathroom and made use of the facilities, then splashed water on my face with my right hand. This time she didn't surprise me. I heard her move out of the darkness of the back corner of the room to ghost toward me. I glanced up to Tara West's amber-colored eyes in the mirror and said, "Tell me I didn't get lucky last night." Her expression never blinked, as though the insinuation had flown past her. She was still dressed in the same clothes and still held herself with the same relaxed composure she always displayed. "You were very lucky," she said. "The bullet went through muscle and missed the bone in the artery. You'll live." I scowled. "I don't feel so lucky." Tara shrugged. "Pain is to be endured. It ends or it does not." I saw her consider my back, then lower portions. "You are in reasonably good shape. You should be able to withstand it." I felt a hot rush of blood to my face, and I fumbled for a towel and awkwardly slung it around my hips. "Are you the one who bandaged me? I made a vague gesture with the fingers of the hand that was holding the towel and preserving my modesty. She nodded. "I am, and I have procured clothing for you that is not soaked in blood. You must dress so that we can help my fiancé." I turned to face her and tried my best glower. She didn't twitch an eyebrow. "What time is it?" She shrugged. "Late afternoon. The sun will set soon, and the moon will rise soon after. We will have no time to waste if we were to reach him before the change." "Do you know where he is?" She shrugged again. "I know him." I let out a breath and slowly walked past her. I went to the paper bag on the floor next to the bed. Inside it, I found a pair of enormous purplish sweatpants and a white T-shirt with an Old Glory flying on it in rippling metallic colors, subtitled, "Invest in America, Buy a Congressman." I wrinkled up my nose at the sweatpants, liked the shirt, and fumbled myself into the clothing, ripping off price tags as I went. "Where are we?" I asked. "A hotel in East Chicago," she said. I nodded. "How did you pay for it?" "I used cash. McFinn told me that the police can track the plastic cards." I squinted at her. "Yeah, they can." I rubbed a hand over my head and went to the mirror again to study myself. I was walking more easily now. The pain wasn't any less, but I was beginning to get more used to it. "Do you have any ibuprofen? Anything like that?" "Drugs," she said. "No." She picked up a set of rental car keys and turned toward the door. "Stop," I told her. She turned to me. Her eyes narrowed. "We are going now," she replied. "We are not going," I replied, "until I have a few answers." Her eyebrows furrowed and she glared at me. Then she turned and walked out of the room, letting in a brief flood of orange-tinted sunlight before the door slammed behind her. I considered the door for a moment. Then I sat down on the bed and waited. Perhaps 3 minutes passed. Then she reappeared. "Now," she said, "we will leave." I shook my head. "I told you no, not until I get some answers." "McFinn will answer your questions," Tara told me. "Now you must leave this place." I snorted and folded my arms over my chest. My shoulder took fire, and I wobbled on the bed before I lowered my left arm again. I left the right one folded across my chest, but it just didn't have the same effect. Where is McFenn? Why did he kill Marconi's business partner and his bodyguards? Or did he kill them at all? You will leave this place, Tara began. Who are you? Why did the pair of you mess up the first circle, the one in your basement? How did you know Kim Delaney? Tara West snarled and seized me by the front of my shirt. You will leave this place now, she said, glaring into my eyes. Why should I? I snarled. And for once I didn't avert my eyes. I stared into her gleaming amber eyes and braced myself for the impact of looking into her soul and for her to peer into mine. Instead, nothing happened. That in itself was enough to make my jaw drop incredulously. I continued to stare, and she didn't blink, didn't turn away, and didn't fall into a soul gaze with me. I shuddered in reaction. What was going on? Why didn't the gaze begin? There were only two kinds of people whose eyes I could meet for more than a second or two. The people who had already met my eyes in a soul gaze were one kind. Inhuman beings from the Never Never were the other. I had never looked on Tara West's soul before. I remembered his soul gaze every time it happened. The experience wasn't the sort of thing you forgot. That only left one conclusion. Whoever she was, whatever she was, Tara West wasn't human. We will leave now, she growled. I felt a surge of defiant grumpiness course through me. Why should I? I whispered back. Because I have called the police and told them that you are here, and you are acting irrational and dangerous, and that you possess a weapon. They will be here momentarily. I think that the police might be feeling threatened, given all the recent deaths. They will be likely to shoot you rather than take chances. She let go of my shirt with a little push and stalked out of the room. I sat on the bed for about 5 seconds. Then I rose and hobbled after her, taking time to snatch my duster from where it was draped over a chair. There were holes in the upper left arm, one in the front of the sleeve, one in the back. It was crusty with dried blood that didn't much show against the black canvas. It was disgusting, but hey, it was mine. The boots and the socks I'd been wearing last night were in it, and I snagged them too. Outside, it was a late afternoon, and streets and highways would soon be crowded with commuters going home from work. Tara had rented a beat-up old car, probably from an independent rental business, rather than from one of those major chains. Good move on her part. It would draw things out while the police methodically went through agency after agency, looking for someone of her description, and they always started with the big places first. I studied her as she got in the car. She was tall and lean and pretty, in a knife-edge sort of way. Her eyes moved around constantly, not nervously or randomly, but with the cool precision of someone making herself aware with everything surrounding her at all times. Her hands were scarred, long-fingered, and strong. The bruise on her head, where I had smacked her with my blasting rod the night before, no, 2 nights before, I had lost a day sleeping in the hotel room, was probably hurting like hell, but she didn't seem to notice it. She drove us out into the streets of East Chicago, one of the distant suburbs of the big city, down at the south end of Lake Michigan, finally turning off into a quiet drive beside a sign that read, Wolf Lake Park. Tara West made me nervous. She'd appeared from nowhere to save me from the back of a police car, but what were her intentions? Was she really trying to help her fiancé keep from falling victim to his family curse again? Or were the two of them working together to remove anyone who could rebuild the magical circle that could contain McFenn and render him harmless? That would make sense, given that once Kim Delaney was dead, they came after me. On the other hand, that didn't fit with a lot of other facts. McFenn, if he truly was a loup-garou, changed into a beast only during the nights of the full moon. At least 6 people had been killed when the moon was waxing full, but not yet all the way there, or after it had been full for 3 nights already and was waning back toward half full again. And Tara West wasn't a werewolf. A werewolf was a human being who used magic to turn into a wolf,
She had looked upon my eyes and not been drawn in. Therefore, she wasn't a human being. Could she be some kind of shapeshifter from the Never Never? MacFin's partner in crime, killing on the off nights to keep suspicion from falling on him? Some sort of being with which I was unfamiliar? Most of my background on the paranormal was Western European in origin. I should have been reading more books on Native American beliefs, South American spooks and haunts, African legend, East Asian folklore. But it was a little late for such regrets. If Tara West was a monster and wanted me dead, she could have killed me already, and she surely would not have bothered to clean and dress my injury. Of course, that begged the question. What did she really want? And that question led the way to many more. Who were the young people I had seen her with the first evening? What was she doing with them? Did she have some kind of cult of followers, like vampires sometimes build up? Or was it something else entirely? Tara pulled onto a little gravel lane, drove a quarter mile up it, and pulled off into the weeds. "Get out," she said. "He will be here, somewhere." The bouncing car ride had come to an end, mercifully, and the sun was still solidly above the horizon, with moonrise not for at least an hour after sunset. So I ignored the pain and pushed my way out of the car to follow her into the woods. It was darker underneath the ancient oaks and sycamores, and quiet. Birdsong came to us from far away, as though the birds were choosing the better part of valor and remaining where the sun could still touch the tree branches. The wind sighed through the woods, sending leaves spinning in all shapes of gold and orange and russet, adding to the thick, crunchy carpeting under our feet. Our steps sounded out distinctly as we moved ahead through the leaves, and the cool wind made me grateful I had thought to drape my duster over my shoulders. I studied the usually quiet Tara. She was walking with exaggerated motions, planting her feet down solidly with each step, as though intentionally trying to make noise. Once or twice, she stepped out of her way to tread on a branch, snapping it with a dry popping sound. I was too tired and sore to go to any such effort. I just walked, and it made more noise than she did. Who says I can't do anything right? We hadn't gone more than a few hundred yards when Tara abruptly tensed, crouching, her eyes scanning all around. There was a whistling sound, and then a bent sapling jerked upright, dragging a noose around Tara's ankle and hauling her across the rock and leaf-covered floor of the woods with a yelp of surprise. I blinked at her, and something came out of the leaves, rose right up like Hamlet's dad from the stage floor. But instead of bemoaning his fate and charging me with avenging him, he slugged me across the jaw. On the same side of my face that already sported dark purple bruises, and sent me spinning to the ground, stunned. I landed badly, but on my unwounded side, and rolled out of the way as a muddy, naked foot stomped down at my head. I grabbed onto it and jerked with more desperation than strength, and the foot's owner fell down beside me. Instead of being slowed, he slapped his arms at the ground as he hit it, in much the same way Murphy did when practicing falls. Then he rolled as I struggled to my hands and knees and slid a hard, strong forearm beneath my throat, locking it there with the other hand and pressing back against my windpipe. "Got you. I got you," snarled my attacker. I struggled against him, but he was bigger than me, stronger than me. He had me down. And he hadn't been shot or beaten up anywhere near as often as I had been in the last 15 hours or so. I didn't stand a chance. Chapter 15. So there I was, being strangled by a ranting, half-naked madman in the middle of the woods, with a she-werewolf dangling from a rope there somewhere nearby. My gunshot wound hurt horribly, and my jaw throbbed from where my buddy the cop had brutalized it the night before. I've had worse days. That's the great thing about being a wizard. I can always tell myself, honestly, that things could be worse. I stopped trying to struggle against the man who was choking me. Instead, I grabbed his wrist and prepared to do something foolish. Magic is a kind of energy. It is given shape by human thoughts and emotions, by imagination. Thoughts define that shape, and words help to define those thoughts.
That's why wizards usually use words to help them with their spells. Words provide a sort of insulation, as the energy of magic burns through a spellcaster's mind. If you use words that you're too familiar with, the words that are so close to your thoughts that you have trouble separating thought from word, that insulation is very thin. So most wizards use words from ancient languages they don't know very well, or else they make up nonsense words and mentally attach their meanings to a particular effect. That way, a wizard's mind has an extra layer of protection against magical energies coursing through it. But you can work magic without words, without insulation for your mind, if you're not afraid of it hurting for a while. I drew in my will, my exhausted fear, and focused on what I wanted. My vision swam with dots of color. The man on my back snarled and growled incoherently, and spittle or foam dribbled onto the side of my face. Dried leaves and mud pressed against the other side of my face. Things started going black. Then I ground my teeth together and released my will with a burst of sudden energy. Two things happened. First, a rush of blinding thought, brilliant and wild and jangling, went through my head. My eyes swam with color, my ears with phantom sound. My senses were assaulted with a myriad of impressions. The sharp scent of earth and dry leaves, the rippling scratch of a centipede's legs fluttering up the skin of my forearms, the sensation of warm sunlight against my scalp, dozens of others I couldn't identify, things with no basis in reality. They were a side effect of the energy rushing through my head. The second thing that happened was a surge of electricity gathered from the air around me to my fingertips, gripped on the attacker's wrist and surged up through his arm and into his body. He convulsed against my back, out of control, and the strength of his own reaction threw him off me and onto his back on the leaves, jerking and flopping, his face stretched in a tight-lipped expression of shock and fear. I wheezed for a breath, stunned and shaking, then scrambled back to my feet, only to stagger against a tree. I huddled there, watching my attacker's convulsions fade into a numb paralysis. Finally, he just stared at the sky, his lips open, his chest heaving in and out. I studied the man a little more closely. He was big. He was really big. At least as tall as me and twice as broad. He was dressed only in a pair of cut-off blue jeans, and those looked like they were ill-fit. He was in condition best described as overwhelmingly masculine. Hairy-chested and muscled like a professional wrestler. There was gray in his hair and beard, and there were lines on his face, putting his age at well into maturity. It was his eyes that showed me the most about him. They burned green, wild and haunted, fastened on the distant sky now, but heavy with the weight of too much terrible knowledge. It couldn't have been easy to live with a curse like his. There was a scrambling sound, a muffled thump, and I looked up to see McFinn's noose trap hanging empty, the rope swinging back and forth. My eyes tracked down to earth to find an indistinct shape stir in the leaves and then resolve itself into Tara West's long limbs and practical clothes. She gathered herself beneath her and crossed at once to McFinn, her chest heaving, her eyes vague and distant. "McFinn," she said. "McFinn! You've killed him!" she snarled, and her eyes snapped up to mine, bright and burning with amber anger. I could have sworn I saw her face start to change, her bared teeth begin to grow into fangs. Maybe that was just the effect of the magic on my perceptions, though, or a primitive, lizard-brain sort of reaction to Tara rising to her feet and charging toward me with a howl. There was murder in her eyes. I hadn't gotten beaten up twice, shot, and nearly strangled to get taken out by a misguided werewolf bitch. I gathered in my dizzy, snapping will and extended my good hand toward the charging woman, flicking my wrist in a circle. "Vento Giastrus," I trumpeted. The winds howled down from the trees and whipped into a savage circle of moving air, lifting up dried leaves, sticks, and small stones. The miniature cyclone picked up the charging Terra up off the ground and hurled her a good 20 feet through the air into the branches of a pine tree. It also hurled out a cloud of rocks and small debris, forcing me to seek shelter behind a tree.